with Dr. Howard T. Odom, a graduate research professor emeritus in the University of Florida's Department of Environmental Engineering Sciences, on behalf of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program at the University of Florida. Dr. Odom, who will turn 77 in 2 weeks, was the longtime director of UF Center for Environmental Policy and the founder of the university's Center for Wetlands. He is recognized worldwide as one of the pioneering figures in the development of systems ecology. He is known for emphasizing both the interrelatedness of humans and nature in balancing energy resources and for developing an economic model to help society quantify the value of its natural resources. In addition to nearly 200 scientific papers, he has published 15 books.
That's probably 300 or 400.
Okay.
Yeah.
In addition to nearly 400 scientific papers, he has published 15 books. Is that right?
Maybe.
We'll double check that. Yeah. The latest, A Prosperous Way Down, written with his wife, Elizabeth C. Odom, was published this year. The interviewer is Cynthia Barnett. The date is August 16th, 2001. The interview is being conducted at Dr. Odom's home, 2106 Northwest 9th Avenue in Gainesville, Florida. Dr. Odom, where were you born and in what year?
Durham, North Carolina in 1924.
Who were your parents?
And my father, Howard W. Odom, sociologist at the University of North Carolina, and mother, Anna Louise Kranz Odom, of German stock descent from Tennessee.
And what brought them to the Chapel Hill area? Your father's job?
Yes, he was head of department of sociology. Before that, he had been what they now call provost at Emory.
Ah. And what was it like growing up in Chapel Hill in the 20s and 30s?
You had three groups in school, the country people, very poor in the Depression times, and the mill workers, and the mill had closed, and they were poor, and then there were the faculty kids, and they at least had all their needs, and the school was crisscrossing like the rest of the country, disturbed with the changes in progress.
Did the groups intermingle?
Some, not really much.
Huh. So you were with the faculty kids
So we were stimulated all the time by doing chess and hanging around the university or doing something in libraries.
Did your family know Frank Porter Graham?
Yes, father and the president, Graham, were, of course, close colleagues and the development of the university there.
And what are your impressions of Frank Porter Graham? What are a few memories of him?
A genial, liberal president. I heard lots of conflicts between my father at home, but over trivial matters.
Can you talk about what it was like growing up the son of someone as renowned and prolific as Howard Washington Odom?
Well, one was not so conscious of those things, and reputations were still being developed, and so all the kids growing up had a vague notion that their parents were doing something useful.
Uh-huh.
We spent a year at when I was going on five at Rollins College, as he was visiting professor, and so I became imprinted with Florida swamps and turtles and cypresses and bald eagles, and I think that imprinting affected me and brought me back to Florida years later.
Interesting. What do you think drove your dad, looking back, to work through the problems he did involving race, folk culture, and welfare in the South? What do you think was the driving?
And the regionalism that he's known for as well. And, which is really, we now call that a systems view, although that word wasn't in use. He came out of a poor farm near Covington, Georgia, and delivered milk and developed a folk feeling And his education was all classic Latin and Greek, and he was always quoting his parables out of those sources. In some way, he ended up with a broader view, and later went on to get both a PhD in sociology and in psychology in northern schools, Clark and Columbia.
How much of his work did he bring home?
Well, his study was cluttered by even more than mine. So his work was at home, and the discussions around the table probably influenced the youngsters. But after the Second World War, when I came back, in the early 20s, then I really had interactions with him for a year there before I went on to Yale.
So you lived at home during that year.
That's right.
And that was the time when you talked to him more about his career.
That's right.
And his research.
Yes, and how he would approach things.
What impact do you think his scholarship had on you?
Well, he used to, at that time he was known over the country. He was president of his sociological society and so on, but. And he had spent a year as visiting professor at Yale, and which is how I came to go to Yale. But at that time, he was discussed that what was most important was making contributions to concepts and theory, which had not been his forte or what he was known for. But he and he thought that was the model, and that's the model I developed, particularly with my major professor, who was a similar type, who didn't go to meetings and become a celebrity, but stayed and did the writing and detailed work. These are patterns that are not so popular nowadays.
Yes, and you're referring to G. Evelyn Hutchinson?
Yes, right.
Okay. It's remarkable that your brother Eugene also is a pioneer figure in the field of ecology. What do you think it was about your upbringings that drove you and Eugene both into careers in ecology?
Eugene is 11 years older, and he was important in my early development because he would teach me things that he just learned in school. And
Eugene did.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And even after he left and was graduate school in Illinois, would send back things for me to do, going and banding birds and doing things that he was interested in those days, which was ornithology, not really ecology.
Uh-huh.
I think my father's influence was in encouraging us to write, as Gene would put out a local newsletter for the neighborhood, and I was encouraged to write as well. And so I think those influences, plus the general university matrix in which we embedded, encouraged us. But Pop's always talking about the larger scale, I think, and in effect transmitted a system view to us. Later on, my military service in the meteorology, I learned this: look from large scale down. You can't predict the weather looking out the window. You have to look at the frontal systems. And so,
now, was your father's view of systems a human view and yours a natural view, or was his view of systems?
His of course was human, but tied to resources as well, and that's his regionalism in the southern regions, and mapping all the resources south, and trying to deal with this the ridiculous situation where the South was importing everything when it had the resources, and of course later it developed its economy after the Depression.
What are your earliest memories related to nature?
Well, those memories in Florida, as I say, on living at Rollins College in the...
And that was in Orlando?
At Winter Park.
Winter Park, yes.
And that lake's still there with the little trains gone and not so many turtles there, and it's pretty polluted, but...
Right.
Uh, the ivory-billed woodpecker and the Carolina parakeet were going extinct then, and we much influenced by Audubon Society writings in towards conservation.
Now, but you were only how old at the time?
I was going on 5 then.
So you didn't know about the ivory-billed woodpecker or
the
caracal?
Very much. Again, my brother's influence on me, and then
wow.
Of course later I read for myself.
Wow, so even before age 5 you were aware of these two creatures?
Yes, I was raised a naturalist.
Yes.
Was
that your mom and your dad who?
No, I think.
Or all Eugene?
That was Eugene. He was, as you say, a bird person in those days. So.
Hmm. Well, how did your mother influence you?
Well, she was, mothers probably determine your character in many ways, and on small scales. And
what are some of the things you would attribute?
She was very much of. Her mother, her grandmother, a strong feminist, and my father even had to leave town when she came to visit because he had taken her away from her mother. But
this was your grandmother?
Yes.
The feminist? What was her name?
Fanny Lieber.
Uh-huh.
Her husband had died. I think she was like many of the women who were educated in those days. They didn't have enough outlets for their so I think she was frustrated, and it contributed to her asthma and so on.
Was that your mother?
Mother, but she was, a member of the American Association of University Women and so on. But she did the things that women tried to do, which is run a big house and a 15-room house that Pop insisted on building as part of the complex that he had from being poor in the South, and have a big house, the biggest in Chapel Hill in those days, and on the highest hill in giant stone castle. Later on, after they died, none of the kids wanted it. It was too big for us, and we sold it to the Christian church. It's
really?
A Christian church now.
So it wasn't there on Franklin Street, it was out?
It was out just south of Med School.
Huh. And so you all sold it after he passed away?
By the time it burned down when I was about 12, February winds, and the word got around, the Oldham house is burning, and everybody in town, the small town of a couple of thousand people, they all came out and they moved the furniture out of the and sat in it while the volunteer fire people tried to put it out, and they'd get one side out and they'd catch on the other side.
Oh,
eventually burned to the ground, but it was the biggest social event in Chapel Hill.
Do you remember what year that happened?
I'd have to look up to get it exactly.
And did your dad rebuild it?
The insurance companies did rebuild it.
What caused the fire?
The redwood shingles and sparks coming out of the old-time furnace.
Hmm. So the house was an overcompensation for your dad's
perhaps
upbringing. That's your
perhaps. Yes, perhaps.
Hmm. Who else besides your mom and dad and Eugene influenced you when you were growing up? Anyone else we should mention?
Well, I know I decided I'd go into science from a 7th grade teacher, Mrs. Davis, and as often.
Was that at Chapel Hill High School?
Yes, Chapel Hill High School. Mm-hmm. In those days, I started with a class that I think that had about 12 people in the first grade and graduated with 40. Give you some idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the entire class.
Mm-hmm.
you get a lot of individual attention that way. And
yes.
So there were good teachers along the way.
How did you decide to pursue zoology, and how did you choose NC State in Raleigh for your undergraduate work?
No, not NC State.
Oh, I thought it was NCSU.
No, it's Chapel Hill.
Oh, you went to undergrad
at
Carolina?
Chapel Hill, sure.
Oh, okay.
And I lived at home. Try to get some college influence. I joined the fraternity and learned how to at least be civil with people who with whom I disagreed entirely on everything.
What sorts of things did you disagree with people about?
In those days I was a teetotaler and I was raised that way, and and their attitudes of women were pretty primitive and sophomoric, and of course the world was coming apart with the war, and so they you had sophomores running the fraternities and things like that.
Yes. How did you deal with this? This was your fraternity brothers. You're an undergraduate teetotaler, and they...
I was still living at home. So,
right.
So I, usual thing. You'd argue some of the time, and just keep quiet some of the time. But.
What led you to volunteer for the Air Force's meteorology program?
Well, all of us at age 17 were trying to decide what would be a good branch to go into, and I saw this advertisement of that they needed meteorologists, and of course we were all, I was taking 23 hours and so on, trying to get enough math and physics to get into good programs, and so I applied and then was accepted, and then we sent to basic training, and funny place, Miami Beach of all places, which was great to come back to Florida. And then we went to engineering training, and they happened to send me right back to North Carolina, where they had a pre-meteorology and then to Chinook Field for officer training, and then we went on. Then I went on from there to forecast weather and gliders, but I had made high grades, and so I was picked to go to tropical weather school and sent to Puerto Rico, and then later on they set up their own tropical weather school in Howard Field Canal Zone. So I was there for a year as an instructor in tropical meteorology. So this is extremely important to me, because that you learn not only about the Earth and processes and the engineering approaches to things, but also this view of the top down, which the systems view, the real systems view.
Was there a significance to the war effort in the meteorology program, or were you sort of removed?
No. This is all focused. That all this instruction had to do with the people we were instructing were coming back from the Pacific and going back out, and when you were trying to develop new methods of forecasting the hurricanes and so on. Example, they sent a civilian down to learn from us named Robert Simpson. Later on, he, after he learned something, he went on the Saffir-Simpson scale that you hear about on the television.
Yes.
This was his scale of hurricane influence. And, as part of that training, I spent a month with Hurricane Patrol out of West Palm Beach, and that was fun, flying into hurricanes. And,
oh my gosh, I didn't realize they did that early.
Oh yeah, that was when it started, and it was operated through the Air Force at the time. It's later made civilian, but and so we went through four different hurricanes during that period. And those days they flew in it. I didn't have the radar. So they flew in at ground level, so we'd be about 600 feet off the waters and trying to take what's called double drift measurements, and the water was slapping the plane,
and
it was in yaw, that's sliding back and forth. Very exciting.
Wow.
And I mean, you just couldn't have a more interesting training than I was lucky enough to have in the Air Force.
Yes. So when you came out of the Air Force, you didn't go straight to Yale?
No, I came back to finish an undergraduate degree.
Okay.
And I picked up in zoology, because I'd already been assisting R.E. Coker with his fish collection before I left, when I was still in high school. And R.E. Coker, who wrote The Great and Wide Sea, and helped set up marine programs there, University of North Carolina, which I later reinforced. I came back to that department, and in the meantime, my father's contact at Yale encouraged me to pull out there, and so I finished the undergraduate degree, and then went on to Yale to, in those days I was going to find the secret of life. And of course, in the first year of graduate school at Yale, and reading one of the famous dynamics of biochemistry, I suddenly realized life is just a complex system. So what if we're going to and to try to understand complex systems at that scale with its fantastic cost and just getting measurements at the microbiological level, I said, there's no point in doing this. Let's go up scale and work with the environment and humans where you can see what you're doing, and then work out the principles of complex systems, which should apply to everything. So that was, and that's been a theme I've always had, and that I think is what the world needs to do, is to realize that there are these common principles that apply to everything, and that humans, in the midst of it, they think that they're making choices, and they are. They're choosing between whether they're going to fit the principle, and thus what they do prevail, or whether they're going to make a mistake and have to drop it. And so that's been our theme, and that's even now is our theme, and that's what it's hard to get across, and most of the ecological society has not bought that, we even have a controversy among my former students about that whether or not the principles that apply both above scale and below scale, whether they are applied to ecological economics, which is the field of one which we started of people, environment, and money.
Are you speaking of the former student Costanza?
Yeah, that's right. We've had this controversy with him.
Okay, let me go back for a moment to Yale, just so finish that idea.
Sure.
G. Evelyn Hutchinson, was this way of looking at systems that you began to undertake, was this different than how ecologists have looked at the world before?
Oh yes.
And how so? Could you explain that?
Ecology at that point was defined as a relationship of organisms and their environment. In other words, it's what's now called auto ecology. It's a small scale thing, and Evelyn Hutchinson's field, one of his fields, was biogeochemistry, which is the cycles of materials, and that's a larger scale systems view of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And he had gotten into that because of a mineralogy father and so on. And so that reinforced. So that's the meteorology is large scale and top down, mm-hmm. and the biogeochemistry is as well. We also had a lot of population ecology there. It was started by Evelyn Hutchinson. And in his mind, there was no conflict there, but the students that came out of that program, retained the large scale, and I'm one example, and those who decided to emphasize this population went down to a smaller scale again, and that entire society has been hurt by it, and people who study one scale, they call it a discipline, and they don't realize that every scale is driven by the next larger scale and uses parts from the lower scale, but the science is hung up on the idea that basic is smaller.
Okay.
And the correct answer is the basic is both smaller and larger.
I still don't quite understand the controversy, though, between the two ways of looking at population.
All right. The ecological community out there, you see the forests, the trees, and the birds, the microbes, and everything. The smaller scale view says this is a struggle of existence between competing populations.
Yes.
And that it's seething, and first one thing is ahead, and then something else is ahead, and
mm-hmm.
and when it's disturbed, you get more variety, and that's all there is to it.
But Darwinism.
Early Darwinism.
Yes.
But see, Darwin, the first book.
Okay.
Whereas Darwin's last book, The Descent of Man, is quite And it was an important reinforcement for me too to read that. It's quite not at all that. It's entirely a systems view. That what's there's a natural selection for the systems that are organized to be cooperative and including the humans. So that's the trouble that so many of the Ecological Society, they never read The Descent of Man.
So where does the value aspect come in? That's so important to you.
Okay. the systems concepts were developed during the Second World War, mm-hmm. and very much in meteorology, and in the post-war university, there was much discussion of systems and energy, and a very remarkable book, Physical Biology by Alfred Lotka, mm-hmm. Hutchinson put me on it, and the the principle, of the thermodynamic laws, there are three laws, and Lotka proposed a fourth one, and that's been, I realized as a graduate student then that this was the explanation of nearly everything, which we, and it was called the maximum power principle, mm-hmm. and that it's self-organization processes that you have among in the forest, or in a chemical solution, or in the stars, or in human affairs.
Mm-hmm.
The systems that prevail are those that, as first priority, pull in the most available energy resources, and as second priority, use it efficiently to make all the processes perform maximum.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, well, why? Why should that be? Well, that's natural selection, but not on an organismal level. In addition to an organismal level, it's on has to do with the design. So it's the all the components of a system, that's people interacting, or if it's birds and trees interacting, there are all kinds of connections that could be made, and the ones that reinforce, that is, that if the bees pollinate to flowers, that reinforces both the bees and the flowers. It puts a closed loop reinforcement, and therefore that design takes over.
Yes.
I do not understand why so much of science, and particularly ecological people, have trouble with understanding the maximum power principle, because we've changed it to, we refined it, we now call it maximum empower principle.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't man have an advantage, an unfair advantage in the system that you just described?
Humans are suffered on this earth as long as they feed back and reinforce the environment, and that's the message that's gradually getting out. So what do humans do for the environment for the whole world that wasn't there before? Well, they're information processors, both mm-hmm. as individuals and also in their social mechanisms that their culture developed, so that they collectively can have this fantastic information processing. And that's why they're reinforcing the earth. And of course, there's this temporary pulse from using fossil fuels. But when you look at that on a longer scale, it's part of something there are a bunch of corollaries that we've learned about all systems, and this applies to people and to Florida and so on, is that they develop these hierarchies, and they do this, and they store mm-hmm. energies and then use it in a pulse.
Mm-hmm.
That gives you more performance.
Mm-hmm.
An earthquake gets more done by than if the plates of the earth move just gradually all the time. They wouldn't get as much done as by building up a strain and then releasing it with a sudden surge. And
mm-hmm.
so you find that in the molecules and the cells of organisms, and then in ladies with pregnancies and people mm-hmm. sleep, because that's mm-hmm. a pulsing system. And
mm-hmm.
And so if we plan for that, so the model that earlier that there was a steady state that you build up and level off.
Yes.
And that came out of ecology. That's Cole's model, and one my brother used to push it. It's not correct. You build up and then you have a pulse.
So,
And then you reset and do it again. And I think most ecologists now are coming to realize that. And we've had other colleagues who contributed to that, such as Buzz Holling.
Mm-hmm. When are you developing these theories? Is it after you've left Yale?
I started as a graduate student.
Okay.
That maximum power stuff is in my dissertation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I know before you arrived here for good in 1970, you were at UF, Duke, UT Austin, University of Puerto Rico, full professor at UNC Chapel Hill. What were some of the most important times during that time when you were a young professor? What sorts of theories were you developing during those years?
Well, of course, came first to Florida for 4 years and working with this and pressure to. I was doing biogeochemistry, and I remember the senior professors came and says, "When are you going to do some biology?" So WCLE, who is a social ecologist, had published this Great Apes book, which summarized everything known about ecology, and that encouraged my brother to do his textbook. But he had an out-of-date framework, and I just brought the new stuff out of Yale and helped him organize it. And of course, he left my name off the first edition.
Your brother did?
And so I told him I'd get a lawyer if he didn't correct it, so the next edition he put it in. But anyway, that...
my gosh.
but they're thinking, you know, there are exchanges between brothers and it's always been a need for us to hold together as best we can and make a joint contribution and reinforce and sometimes write together. And so... But there's been problems.
So you've also been competitive.
Well, I never felt it, but my brother, apparently, I know he just had a biography published. Lady, nice lady in Athens, and that's when I realized he was driven by competition by me. I never even thought of it.
Well, you were the upstart little brother.
That's right, that's right. So the younger one, I never felt any competition from him at all. Besides, my background's entirely different in meteorology, and I took the equivalent of an undergraduate major in chemistry. And so, there was no really, my engineering training was all quantitative, and his was in another direction. So. But over the years, he's been a genius at reaching people because during the war he taught 18 hours of elementary courses to ignorant kids off of Georgia's farms and learned to reach people who had poor backgrounds. And so he's been. So that's been his strength, is to cultivate feeding ideas to people at a rate they could take them and not shocking them. Whereas my tendency is to say, that's a stupid idea, this is what's correct. And that's not the way that's not the way to influence people.
So when you read his biography recently, you learned things that you hadn't realized.
Well, I didn't read
it,
I scanned it. That was interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah. And yet over the years you have collaborated on books, right?
Sure. And then when his son died prematurely of liver diseases, Martha, his mother, to help out, I wrote a draft of a paper that by William Odom and then Gene Odom, my brother, and myself. So we put out, and we call that the pulsing paradigm, although the idea of that was already in my systems ecology 20 years earlier, that it was a good chance to take Gene to use my nephew's very nice history and work researches, and, mm-hmm. and so we do things like that. And,
yes.
We put out a paper recently. I think lots of people in ecology say, well, as a Romanian approached me at an international conference a couple of years ago in Denmark, and he says, I hear your brother's a good ecologist and you're the bad ecologist. And he says, but I think, but he says, well, why don't you come give us a lecture and let us see, and so on, you know. I think that view of, I guess I stop. I lost my thread there.
Well, let me ask you, what did he mean by you're the bad ecologist and your brother is the good ecologist?
Because
you challenge the challenge system?
And also they don't, people at one scale don't want to be told that the answers are not in modeling up from their parts, but in aggregating all this detail in order to deal with the next scale.
Mm-hmm.
That is half the knowledge is there, and the other half, you have to go look. Science is badly hurt by letting disciplines study one scale. So,
mm-hmm.
but that's the kind of thing. And also, if you're in an engineering college, the ecologists assume that you're somehow hurting the environment.
Ah, I see.
Yeah.
You're messing with it. You're manipulating it
Something,
somehow.
Who knows?
Would you say, I'll just ask one more question about your brother. Would you say you're close to your brother?
We were, of course, very close up till the time we had that problem with that book.
And, mm-hmm. then, and that was early in your career. So.
That was in 1953.
Okay.
But, 54, but we've worked together many times since, I had to learn to be cautious.
Yes.
Yes. We've given the Institute Levy Prize, and that was great going to Paris, and that's a group that normally doesn't look at environment, but environment was popular, and so they departed from their molecular biology interests and gave us this prize. And
so you were awarded that prize jointly.
Yes, and mm-hmm. And so then some of the people on that committee were from India, and Jean suggested that sent me a letter and said, let's put our summary papers from this that we made a presentation, and mine was what we now call transformative, which is fundamental to concepts.
Mm-hmm.
So let's put it in the Indian journal. They uh-huh. would be happy with us. So I did, and it came out. And then, but his didn't turn up there. It turned up in the front page of Science.
Oh, my gosh.
So he got the Tyler Award the next year. It was interesting. So I had to learn that,
wow.
I don't know what was, on the other hand, Gene pushes our stuff. Now I remember the other point. People see that when Gene's ready to adopt one of HT's ideas, mm-hmm. it must be all right.
Ah, that must be frustrating.
No, it's not. It's not at all. The idea of being first in something that's the model I have.
And, yes.
Even in Hutchinson was that way. He didn't go around trying to be influential. He wrote his papers, and once in a while he'd go to a meeting, but not often. So, anyway, there are more than one model.
I know you had grant work in Florida as early as 1953. Could you talk about some of the earliest work you did in Florida?
Florida in those days didn't have any research grants. It was just starting, and uh-huh. the Office of Naval Research was set up, and so we got one of the first grants in the entire university.
Hmm.
And then we had small projects. We had a little project on phosphorus from the Florida Geological Survey, you know, mm-hmm. $500, which is like $5,000 now. But
yes.
And one from engineering on red tide and so on. So so part of that was developing the concept that I had learned from Evelyn Hutchinson, who was a, who many people call a limnologist, that is a student of lakes. And so I was really a limnologist, and WCLE, when he came down here and set up, changed the Department of Biology, and he gave me that course. And so anyhow, my work, early work, was limnological, and so the role of phosphorus, which seemed to be extreme in Florida, and then appearing in all kinds of interesting places in waters. And so we, so I early work relating where things were eutrophic, that is nutrient rich, and where they were oligotrophic, and what resulted. And so that's one of our earliest contributions there. And those, we didn't have a lot of measurements of $500, and but they're, even now, that's the only ones they have to decide whether Lake Okeechobee and other places, how it has changed.
So those early studies are what they rely on now to measure.
They can't rely on two or three numbers very much, but still, we did make this survey.
What did you learn about the role of phosphorus in Florida's lakes?
Wherever acid waters of swamps crossed phosphate rocks, and you had more phosphorus, and so you had more fertility.
Was that good or bad?
Well, in those days, that was regarded as good, and Canada had sent people to work with Hutchinson to talk about fertilizing all the lakes of Canada. So the idea in those days was, let's get everything more eutrophic.
Wow.
But I got to Florida, and it was already eutrophic in a great many places, and surviving fairly well with it. I mean, it was fairly well adapted to eutrophy and the low oxygen conditions, and many of the fishes could live with it and so on. We found this huge, the chemical tests are blue, and so all of a sudden this blue-black solution in the tributary of the present Rodman Dam, you know, and so my God, we just discovered a new phosphate deposit. Of course, it was the Orlando sewage.
My gosh.
So, and I remember in those days, old man Phelps had made his name and well known in environmental engineering for understanding the behavior of oxygen in waters. Well,
and
he came down to Florida and was helping out, and they were using that, what's now the Center for Wetlands, this old building, and I came and showed him some of the results, and you know, here I'm fresh out of school, a couple of years out, and he's at my present age, and he says, "Oh, nutrients aren't very important," you know. I mean, it was just an incredible misunderstanding in those days of the role of nutrients in controlling the all of the waters and their nature in Florida.
And what was Phelps's first name? This is the guy the Phelps lab is named for, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's
okay.
Right.
I'll fill that in. If you could just follow up on what's changed about the phosphorus in our lakes now.
Well, whenever consumption is greater than plant production, then the consumption process turns loose nutrients. It turns loose the phosphorus and nitrogen and all the other things. And so modern society, because it burns fossil fuels and uses fertilizers straight from mining, turns loose huge quantities. So now we have this super eutrophy wherever humans are, coming off the highways, coming out of the cities, coming off the sewages, coming out of the boats, coming off everything. So all of a sudden we have more nutrients being turned loose all over Florida than it can accept. And of course, one of our greatest contributions, and probably don't get enough credit for it, is after I came back to Florida in 1970, and we set up the Center for Wetlands with a $1 million grant from Rockefeller Foundation, NSF, following some experiments I'd done in North Carolina, which had built on knowledge of the rainforest early. You know, these things build, and you learn. And
so in the Amazon?
And included some of our measurements there even, but that the natural, that wetlands are nature's way of taking in excesses. and binding them into, back into organic matter. There is a, they redeposit peats and so on. And so we set up experiments to show that, and we had a national workshop in 72. And immediately everybody came to that national workshop.
So even the scientists didn't know the value
That's
of
right.
wetlands before
That's
that
right.
time.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they knew that in general that they were interesting ecological places, but mm-hmm. this particular role, and many scientists even now will and the conservation, the negative type conservation, will oppose the use of wetlands for this purpose, which is to accept the wet. And of course, that's easily fixed. You don't have to use natural wilderness wetlands for this. You can build new ones, and that's
yes.
what we learned to do. It's a, it's because it's so easy to control water levels, and once you control
yes.
them, then you get the right hydro period, and then you get then you multiple seed it with many kinds of species, and let nature self-organize and give you back what pattern fits that particular condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so so this is now all over the world in the magazines and journals and the rest. And of course, former students founded the Ecological Engineering
mm-hmm.
a journal, and we now had a new society, and it met for the first time in Athens, and we had my brother Gene give one of the keynote speeches. And
what was the name of the new society?
American Society of Ecological Engineering.
Okay.
And Ecological Engineering.
Just one moment. This is side two of tape one, and you left off on ecological, the American Society of Ecological Engineering.
Ecological engineering differs from environmental engineering in that it expands the scale to include the ecosystems around the engineering technology. For example, wastewater is coming out of a pipe. Environmental engineering works with processes in the technology to try to get the waters to be appropriate to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
But ecological engineering takes a step further and says we're going to let self-organization, that is nature's design, work with us, and so we're going to adjust not only what we put out, but help the environment and manage it in such a way that it can develop an interface that benefits from the waste, and because we don't, there's no such thing as waste in ecological engineering. It's mm. byproducts, mm. but they're not waste.
Mm. That's interesting.
Yeah, so.
And what year again was the National Wetlands Conference?
Well, that was 73, I guess.
Okay.
Ed Pyatt, who was chairman of our department, and we had a Rockefeller planning grant for 1 year, and we did that workshop as part of that. And then from that, we turned in the $1 million proposal. And we got a lot of endorsements. We had Reuben Askew's letter endorsing it. And,
mm-hmm. How about Stephen C. O'Connell? Was he instrumental?
And this had to be approved, of course. So these big grants projects had to be reviewed. I thought maybe he might not approve it, because I had ended up testifying in favor of a wildlife professor who had been very activist in IFAS and had been attacking concepts, and they wanted to fire him, and he challenged it, and there was I remember Manning Dower was mm-hmm. was the attorney for defense, and he had me testifying, but my testimony was just to show that they were that IFAS at that time was not following his FREIA process for faculty as in engineering and in biology, because I had been in both those departments, so I could speak some authority, he didn't hold it against me.
What was the name of the wildlife professor? Do you remember?
That's what I'm going to have to look
up. Okay, we'll fill that in.
Yeah.
And
he eventually left. I don't think he was, I mean, I think he chose to leave, but it stirred the campus up badly.
What specifically was the controversy? Why did they want to get rid of him?
I'd have to review that.
Okay, we'll fill that in.
Yeah,
That sounds like interesting story.
That it is, and it was a milepost for the university in a time of, this is, I believe the first Earth Day was 66, and I was still in North Carolina at that time, but this is a time of expanding environment, and
yes,
you had activism, and they were trying to punish a wildlife person, and trying to say that, but I looked at his papers, and his published papers seemed to be reasonable, and there was just no basis for firing him just because he was speaking out.
Wow, yeah. Wow. That brings me back to when you first came here as a full professor in 1970, I wanted to ask you to characterize the environmental outlook of the three campus groups, students, faculty, and administrators.
Here
in Gainesville, yes. Was the student body beginning to pick up on the environmental movement?
Yes, it had not been as active here as in some other universities, such as in Chapel Hill.
Yes.
But nonetheless, so it was developing later. At Chapel Hill, I'd been appointed in three departments, and I was a professor in the botany, in zoology, and environmental science and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And I also I organized, in memory of R.E. Coker, I organized the marine program up there, which was a major, an interdepartmental major, and we also set up the ecological program. Well, so coming to Florida, but I learned during that you had no one chairman would back you. So when I came to Florida, when they asked me if I wanted to join the other departments, that I had once been a part of, which is like biology, I said no, and I said, if I'm going to do engineering, I'm going to stick with it. And so at that time, this Department of Environmental Engineering Sciences, it was really quite innovative because it had half engineers and half scientists, and they were all trying to deal with these problems. And so it was a very creative time, a lot of good mixing the hydrology and and then this, so our wetlands, so there were other, to answer your question, I think all of the departments, environmentally related departments, were innovating at that time.
Hmm. And you helped shape the university's policies on environmental education, right, during that time?
Yes.
How did the administration?
Well, what happened was the question is what the environmental curriculum should be, and there was already a competition as to who's going to do the environment, and so they appointed a committee, and they this is the provost then was later acting president, I think his name in it, but that you know very well.
Bryant.
Yeah. And, so we had but they appointed administrators to my committee. So and so we met for a whole year and put out a report. Archie Carr was on it, and when it got, and the question was whether to put in an undergraduate environmental science program, and it split down the middle, and it was because the member from medical refused, abstained, and forced the vote into a tie, which meant there was. So we submitted a final report that had a majority and a minority.
Did the vote line up? Administrators opposed?
Yes, it did. No, yes, because they wanted to push their own program. They didn't want some campus wide program.
Right.
And so we had the IFAS dean was against it, and my chairman was against it, and so on.
And what was the medical program's beef with it?
He said environment is a fly by night. He thought it was a passing fad, and didn't see any point in setting up a new curriculum.
And now they have a whole College of Natural Resources, and
well, that's later when it came up again. And so, but at that time, I went out of town for a month and summer, when I came back, one of the deans had come over and picked up all the copies of the report and destroyed them.
Oh, my gosh. And
I decided not, no point. There are times to fight and times not. And,
right.
But then years later, the pendulum on environment swung and
yes.
swung back. And we had a lot of strength on this campus in environment and maybe 20 departments. I mean,
yes.
there's entomology and aquatic plants, all kinds of places. And ag engineering. And I proposed environmental college
mm-hmm.
and sent it out there and hit a nerve, and all of a sudden it caught fire, and so they set up a set of committees, and the first time they had the faculty interested to come out to a general meeting, 300 turned up.
Oh my.
And later on it sifted down to smaller numbers, and so then the outcome of that is the one that Humphrey now directs.
Mm-hmm.
And even then there was a struggle as to whether that should be within IFAS or be a separate.
Mm-hmm.
But of course it's a virtual college and it doesn't have any budget except for
right.
some fellowships and some secretarial help.
Did you argue that it should be outside of IFAS?
Yes, I thought it was that needed to be independent.
Yes.
It's a full-fledged college.
Yes.
It's status. That's still the issue now. That was for an undergraduate
right.
program. And then for graduate, in order to give strength to ecology, I propose an ecology major, interdepartmental major,
mm-hmm.
And that was picked up, and it was separate, but then it was combined into this environmental college, and so Humphrey picked up on that, and so that's their, and again, it's not as good as a regular college,
uh-huh.
but the problem is that environment cuts knowledge one way, if you have the typical disciplines of chemistry and physics and forestry
mm-hmm.
and all, you can line them up like that
mm-hmm.
and say each one of these has got a set of principles and that's
right.
a discipline. But when you go to train somebody in environment, you need some of each, so then
yes.
you cut it the other way. And so, the whole country now is struggling with this. I check at Yale every summer when I go up there, and they just put in a new environmental college,
mm-hmm.
adapted their former forestry and renamed it, and moving towards an environmental college. So
mm-hmm.
different places, but some places it has environmental studies, which are pretty weak.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they're not required to learn
very much
quantitative stuff.
Uh-huh.
They learn the qualitative sides of it, and it's useful, and it's good. General education, and some places set up a hardcore sciences, and then others try to compromise between.
I guess we'll go back to 1971 when Environment, Power, and Society is published. Could
okay.
you talk a little bit about that book and its impact? That was one of your most important books, right?
Yes. We started writing chapters even as I was doing the rainforest work, and they were rejected at first, and then they changed their mind and encouraged me to finish it. And this was an attempt to use systems concepts to understand all systems, but particularly this scale of humans and the environment.
Uh-huh.
And by this time we had evolved a set of symbols that represent the way the world breaks systems into units.
Yes.
And so that it's a general systems language, and it had an energy aspect and mathematical aspect, and so if you go, it's the verbal thinking that people have, everybody, including the mathematicians, they were raised at their mother's knee, and they, so they say, well, this gets stored, and this interacts with that, and this causes that. Well, those are verbal models, and that immediately elicits what the symbols in the drawings look like. And then the minute you've done that, you've written the equations, and you can just copy, translate, and write the equations, and therefore you put them in a computer program and simulate. So that general connectivity concept, I guess, was hit a nerve and was fairly new, and many people were influenced. Even, for example, the input-output energy people apparently got their ideas out of one of my diagrams and so on.
And is this the time when you explain the concept of emergy with an M?
We call it, in those days, we were still calling it embodied energy.
Uh-huh.
That is energy that went into something.
Yes.
It's embodied. But and then there were other concepts with that same name, and they were getting confused, and people were attacking each other, and yet they were all dealing with embodied energies and so on. And
mm-hmm.
So that in 1983 we realized that what we were doing is not what some other people are doing, and that it's separate, and
mm-hmm.
it should have a name that not use some English name
mm-hmm.
that everybody would be confused about, which is what ecologists have done in the past. They
right.
keep taking English names and
right.
reusing them in some narrow way. But so we used a new one, emergy, which is, in short, is an energy memory. It's a memory of what was used up to make something.
And it's basically a measurement of the value of natural systems?
If all real value, real wealth, if you like,
uh-huh.
Requires work to be done, the second law, everything falls back into, diffuses apart, falls apart,
uh-huh.
and you have to keep building it back up, it'll fall apart. You build your house up, and it gradually erodes and falls apart.
Right.
And their body's doing that all the time. And so the work that required to make something
mm-hmm.
or to sustain something is that work is real wealth, and
mm-hmm.
that's the measure of it, and
mm-hmm.
it applies to all scales. The problem is that energy at one scale is different from energy at another scale. That is, it takes a lot of phytoplankton to make a little zooplankton, to make a few fishes, to make a giant fish.
Yes.
A joule or a calorie of
mm-hmm.
one level is not equivalent to calorie. It takes a million calories
mm-hmm.
at this level to make that one. And yet, and people who are trying to do energy analysis and deal with value have been hung up, and they renamed it, by the way. They now call it exergy, which is available energy that can do work. But they're adding these together as if they were the same, and that's wrong. And engineers have known for a long time that they shouldn't add electricity and coal, because
mm-hmm.
it takes four coals to make one electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And that principle applies to everything. So what we do is put everything in units of one kind.
Uh-huh.
That's called energy, is the memory of what it takes through all the pathways in terms of one. So the whale maybe has 10 million joules of sunlight, so you put them on an appropriate basis. And the conversion from one to another is called transformity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the value system, and
mm-hmm.
it's gradually pushed around. And, of course, we have a conference 2 years ago here on energy, and Mark Brown was added to this book.
Could you?
And we're having one September 20th here, the next one. Every other year we have this.
Could you give me an example of an emergy analysis you would do using a Florida example?
Yeah.
Could you give an example that would help readers of this document
yeah.
see how this
yeah.
is effective?
Yeah. one of them, and it's in our main hard full detail book is this one, but
Environmental Accounting, MRG, yeah, and Environmental Decision Making.
Yeah, and one of the examples in there is the Santa Fe Swamp is the headwaters of Santa Fe River, and also part of the Santa Fe Lake, and so to save money, I believe it's Georgia Pacific was going to dig up that peat.
Yes.
You know, about 3 meters of it, and use it for fuel, and of course that takes away. They didn't realize how much, but the public had an instinct about it and opposed it.
Right.
And so the question, so they said, well, we'll give it to the county or something. And the question is, how much is it worth for taxes and other things like that?
Mm-hmm.
And we did a radiocarbon measurement on it, had it done, and it was 1,500 years it took to make it. And so if you take the work of nature times 1,500 years, you have the value of the peat. It comes out a couple of billion dollars in equivalent in what we call M dollars, that is the energy contribution to the gross economic product due to that. So this thing, M dollars, is the economic equivalent of energy. And so we think all public decisions need to be made with M dollars.
What was the reaction of Georgia Pacific and public officials to your value?
That was really interesting. They sent their lawyers around. I never heard the final details of that. I did learn that they sent the same question to my brother.
Oh my gosh!
I'm not sure what he turned in, but ours is published anyhow. But the point is that environmental things are worth much more than you pay for them, because the money doesn't go to environment; it goes to people to process it,
right?
And it doesn't recognize at all how much nature's put into it. Nature might have put a little in it, or might have put a lot in it. You can't tell from just what you pay somebody to bring it to you.
You've said one problem with energy evaluation has been fear of the correct answer by government and private sources. Can you explain?
When this, when the mitigation business of in Florida, you can develop that wetland by enriching another one or protecting another one. And when that started, the people getting ready to deal with this and their billion-dollar levels involved, they had me come around and present these concepts and so on.
Right.
And then they backed off, and because the state wouldn't do it. The state wanted to use its present method, which is some kind of committee actions. And I asked one of the people in the a former student, actually, in NDP, why they weren't using it and why they backed off, and said they were afraid of it. And they were getting a lot of money to protect the environment with the present method of mitigation, and they were afraid they might not get as much. And then the people whose private lands, the developers who were trying to do the development, they were fearful of something. They believed they could do better with the present system of personal interactions and whatever the present method is.
Right.
The idea among the public and most people is that value is in the eye of is market value, is economic value, what people will play, and that there is no natural value system. Whereas people in thermodynamics know there is, although they're arguing about the best way to measure it. So, but the majority, particularly in a society that had 2 centuries of explosive growth and nothing seems to, particularly up to setback on the information recently, there didn't seem to be any limit to anything, and that therefore energy had nothing to do with anything. See, so they don't believe there's any that if you want something, you just advertise and you can have it. You know, so that's the struggle between the reality of value and the public's sadly perception, and it's going to be a drastic change. I don't know whether I'll live to see it, but anyhow, our recipe for that, as you know, is in this new book, The Perilous Way Down, how to deal with it once the shock hits us.
Let me ask you, aren't we doing constructed wetlands now and private wetlands mitigation now?
Yes.
And do you think that's working?
The developing wetlands for wastewaters, I think those are doing real well. I think they keep doing stupid things like spending $100,000 to plant what they want to plant, and by next year they're all dead and something else has come in and covered it nicely
right. By
nature. But I mean, they haven't quite learned the difference between self-organization, which is ecological engineering, is let nature tell you how to fit.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, there's plenty of problems like that, but in general there should be a wetland between every outflow of every agriculture and every runoff and every sewage drain and any open waters. And that, I think that principle's out there. The mitigation, I'm not up to date on how many of those mitigation swamps are really working. I think the notion that we'll get rid of all the little ones and have one big swamp safe somewhere else, that's a mistake. The little wetlands are what keeps the superficial groundwaters wet and keeps the forests from getting too hot and keeps them from exploding into fires when you get droughts. And
so even one of the teeny tiny wetlands you see when you're driving on the interstate and they're like in the middle of the median, those are even important.
Absolutely.
Yes.
The big mistake in the forestry industry was to drain those, and they're not completely drained, and they so most planted forests still have about 5 or 10% of the areas in little cypress or gum or some other little wetlands, and but they're partly drained, and the sooner they fill them back, the sooner they'll protect their own forests by maintaining the superficial water levels. In other words, nature's self-organization of water was to maximize productivity of the landscape, and that's what people want.
Right.
The same thing, and it was short-sighted to try to get that little bit of extra land.
Right. We just took a short break, and you were just mentioning that Emergy has been used in two lawsuits that were settled out of court. Are you able to talk about those at all?
Well, sure. The one in which a landowner had dredged some mangroves down in, I guess it was Lee County, and against the rules of both the state and the Corps of Engineers. And so the state lawyers heard about our method, and so they came to me, and it was interesting that they caught on to Emergy quicker than my own students. And
what year was that? was it in the 80s or 90s?
No, it was 90s, but I'll have to back check that. But it was not with the present administration of DEP.
Mm-hmm.
So when we had preliminary hearings, and then their environmental consultant resigned, and then we had the second hearing, and they settled out of court because it, whereas the market value of some wood and a few fish, $1,000 a level, the destruction of a whole coastal protection system of mangroves and tidal exchanges and so on comes out in the $1 million level.
So you think eventually this will begin being used in development lawsuits?
I think so. It may take people a while to accept that market value is not the correct value.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's one correct value. It's what it's worth to people. It's what it's worth to businesses.
Yes.
But it's not a measure of the effect on the economy.
Yes.
The public economy and its value.
And so Emergy will always be far greater than market value.
Usually not. Once in a while, the drought in Texas got so bad in one place that people were willing to pay water, more water than the water was.
Yes.
Nature's water was worth. So it can happen, but it's not usual.
So I know when you came up with the concept of emergy, you said you believed that having such a rational, science-based measure of real wealth would eliminate much of the rancor and adversarial decision-making that plagues environmental issues. But it seems today that the rancor is only growing greater. It seems worse than ever. Why would you say this is?
Well, that's part of any system. You build up and store the need for something, and when it gets to a threshold, then it flips. I mean, this we already discussed that with earthquakes and with storms, and this also applies to human affairs.
So that's a natural occurrence, and you believe it'll flip.
Sure. But the best example that connects with my father again, all during the time I was growing up, my father was always speaking, you know, this racial harmony and trying to, and he was one of the moderate Southerners who tried to say that the way to do it was to do it gradually.
Yes.
By doing it a little here and a little at a time. And it looked to me like we weren't getting anywhere. Nothing was happening. But of course, what you had was a gradual buildup of beliefs and so on. And then Martin Luther King hit the nerve and it flipped.
Yes.
Well, that's a good example.
So your dad was right?
Not quite. He was wrong about how to do it.
Uh-huh.
Of course, he was right at what he was trying to get done, but you don't do it by gradualism. He's partly right.
You do
it by educating and writing and so on, but it still doesn't happen until everybody has something that brings it to the center stage, and you look at it, and then they flip.
I misunderstood. So there has to be a sort of boiling point?
Yes, there has to be some kind of trigger to release it. Then that pulsing then gets it done quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And human culture has been built, both genetic and social inheritance, have been built to do that, because that's the natural, what energy requires of any system. So the general systems concept apply to human affairs in the same way.
So you think both sides of these rancorous environmental issues will eventually have that same sort of revelation?
Yeah, there's so many issues here, right?
Right.
But the one we were talking about was whether the public would come to, whether the majority of the public would then be ready to accept a new valuation method, and whether they will call it emergy or call it something else, it will happen in a flip.
Is now a good time to talk about the controversy with the former student Costanza? Was that about emergy, or is that something?
Bob was one of our. He and Mark Brown were in the same general class, and so on, and. He was in architecture, and Merritt fired him, and I decided to take him back in, and then our Department of Energy grants, which we had several years of, the people managing that grant says, your stuff doesn't seem to be the same as the stuff out of Illinois, which does embodied energy by the input-output method. And we think you all ought to get together. So I says, okay, we'll send one of our best graduate students, Bob Costanza, up to... So we sent him up there, and he was... It worked pretty well. He got them interested, and so he adopted their method and came back with it. About that time, I went to New Zealand on a year their special fellowship, and so he kind of finished up the time I got back and so on. So he went to, in his first jobs, he applied our methods, but he wasn't getting as much influence. He started interacting with Daly at Louisiana, and so he believed he could get more influence by not opposing economists, but joining them. And so he helped start Ecological Economics. He put all of us on the board of the new journal and got started. And we, there were important conferences in Sweden and so on. And at some point, however, there's a deep struggle there. And one of the main issues is again, market value versus other value. So he stopped using the embodied energy and adopted the economists' input-output method, and also their point of view that value is determined with people that are using economic methods more. So he took us off the board. They had the 65th, about that time, they had the 65th my birthday celebration. It was held in North Carolina, and that's where that book, Maximum Power, that you've seen. So that was argued there. Most of my former students didn't know what to make of it because they weren't all involved in all of that. So is there
a continuing conflict today between ecological economics and emergy?
No, ecological economics, I think we founded it not only through Bob Costanza, but through other people and so on. Emergy is part of ecological economics. But that particular journal, since he's editing it, they always find ways to not to publish it. The only time they published it was a Mark Brown's paper with one of the critics. And so they published it because they thought it was a criticism. The next year, the paper was given an award as the best thing in the journal. But there's only been one in that journal. We've published elsewhere.
And is Costanza still the editor of Ecological Economics?
Yes, he's no longer runs that society, but he's editor. And I've talked to him since. I don't think we're, I think we're both trying to do the same thing, trying to get this economics and environment together. And I think the ultimate outlet for ecological energy is to be adopted by the economics, because they are concerned with people and value, whereas ecologists regard that as a dirty application, and so they won't look at it. So energy is opposed with three groups. One is the ecologists who regard this as some kind of a application of their if useful at all, it's something applied, which is in among many scientists, that's a dirty word. And then it's has been opposed by economists who, at first glance, think that you're trying to displace market value. And of course, we're not. Market value still applies for individuals and businesses, and it's what people have to use. And that this is not that, and it's not to be substituted for that. Then the third group is some of the thermodynamicists don't want to give up the idea that energies can be added, the exergy and its available energy.
I didn't understand the third group. I'm sorry. Okay. What was the third group?
Thermodynamicists.
Okay.
Who by and large, we're really part of that. My own background is pretty heavy with thermodynamics from both chemistry and from meteorology. But they're still trying, many are still trying to add joules of a paper I just reviewed yesterday for Bioscience. They were adding the joules of beef to the joules of corn as a measure of total production. And that's absurd, because it takes many, many joules of corn to make one joule of beef, you see.
Yes.
So to add them as if they were in some way comparable is ridiculous. But getting that across is slow, because it's a paradigm shift, and people don't want paradigm shifts, because that all of a sudden they turn around and say, "Oh my gosh, every paper I published should have been different," and they don't want to do that, and they're going to oppose you.
Right.
So they have to die first before it's accepted, and that's what's going to happen.
So the basic difference between you and the economist would be that they put human value, and you place systems value.
I don't like you to put it that way.
Okay.
The measure that we have, that economists, I think, are going to use increasingly is a second value of what the contribution of real wealth, how to measure real wealth, and economists need to deal with that as well as market value, which is what people value. And then both these systems of the circulation of money using market value and the real wealth, they're coupled together, and we know how, and we've been able to show that. So it's not against economists, although we lost opportunities in the early years by letting, by coming on the way you just did.
Yes.
And so we made it mad. And what made it worse, when I came back in 1970 with some of these ideas to this campus, I gave talks in economics that were reasonably well received.
Mm-hmm.
And then they formed an energy center and got a personable fellow, a former fisherman named Tom Robertson, in engineering this was, under Dean Schmutz, and to form an energy center, because this is the energy crisis and all the things was developing, and the Arab embargo and everything. And then he went around saying, oh, the economists are all wrong and Odom is right, and then that just blocked us out completely, and we've had to live that now. Tom Robertson is still, in the way, he's a good friend, but at the same time, he's hurt us a lot. And right now, he's helping to manage the discussion group that has about 500 members on. In my emails fill out every day. I have to read some of them and throw the rest away. About 50 come in a day on new energy crisis. And this is part of a group that's called Die-Off.
Oh, boy, I've seen this. That guy found me. Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about.
Tom Robertson.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, see, he was in charge here for a while, and then when Dean Schmutz, Assistant Dean Schmutz in Engineering, left, and Tom Robertson left, and he's always, and he had, he stirred up a lot of things, and but it didn't pull the camps together, and so they canceled the Energy Center. Then they formed another one under Capehart, which is very narrow within engineering, but Capehart's retiring, and so now there isn't one. So our Center for Environmental Policy is the only thing there is, and we're just right now a publication of a secretary and some cooperative faculty doing publications, and we need to reestablish an energy center, but this university and the regents and all that is so in such a fluid state that I don't know where that niche is going to come from. My attempt to talk to the new president, I scared him. He's heard the word environment and ran.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How about the provost? He seems to be environmentally conscientious.
He's different.
Let me ask you about applying value. Pollution credits and things like industry solutions like wetland mitigation banks, how do those fit in to your model? Do you see those types of things as effective?
Yes, the alternative that has the highest maximum, the maximum empower principle, and we say empower rather than power because then that means make sure that we're adding energies on a common basis. And so the public policy that will succeed is the one that generates the most real wealth. And so you calculate that from the energy. So you've got mitigation alternatives. So how much of this is equivalent to that?
Right.
We need to put it on energy. But energy, and we immediately convert it to M dollars.
Right.
So that people will have can understand the magnitude.
So do you think that the people who are carrying out pollution credits and the like are doing it right?
Well, they're not using this measure now.
Right.
So this it's a guessing business, and sometimes a thing, you know, that the EPA is now finally considering it. There's a former student, Dan Campbell, is part of the EPA in Rhode Island, and they're some of its staff have been looking into energy this past month.
Okay, so the concepts are the right way of thinking about it.
And the measures.
Okay.
The measures are sound.
I wanted to go back to 1971 because I we skipped over something I wanted to ask you about. I think it would have been 71 when Governor Ruben Askew made his first calls for Florida to manage growth. And our initial growth management laws passed the following year. Were you involved in the governor's first growth conference?
I believe so. I think he had me on the platform one time. I can't say which one it was.
Okay.
But then at a later time, he kept his distance. I mean,
why? What happened?
I don't know. Huh. It's hard to say that people get labeled as extremists and politicians trying to be middle of the road. So.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, he came along 2 years later and endorsed, wrote a letter.
For the Center for Wetlands.
Yeah, sure.
For your Rockefeller grant.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. What was it about your involvement in the growth conference, do you think, that turned him off?
I can't remember that. I'd have to dig in my papers to learn something on that. But let me mention another one.
Mm-hmm.
When Governor Graham, mm-hmm. our present senator,
yes.
Had a later conference.
Right.
And I was on that one, and they had a lot of subgroups, and I was made chairman of one of the subgroups, with 10 citizens from all walks of life. And so we kicked around all these things, and then they had the big session with several hundred people in a giant room, and we all made reports. And so, and I made a report on our group on what we had agreed on, and then I says, well, what we didn't agree on was, and I said a couple of things having to do with evaluation, and also about the need to be working on what to do when growth stops, because this isn't probably in the 80s, and we can see clearly that fuels are going to tighten up, and although the pendulum had swung, and of course Graham was a former developer, so but he admonished me in front of 300 people.
Did he?
He said, it's ridiculous, the growth's not going to stop. Of course, he was quite correct in the short run, and he's quite wrong in the long run.
So you actually think Florida's growth will stop?
Of course.
How will that happen?
Not only Florida's growth, but the world economy.
Yes.
Well, Florida just tracks the rest of the country. It's partly driven by tourism. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's dropped. Right now, we have some cutback in the economy. So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Florida cuts back. If you calculate the energy carrying capacity of Florida, it's 15% mm-hmm. of the present. So it's got to come back to 15%. And that means you cut standard of living 15% or you cut the population mm-hmm. 15% or some combination.
Could you explain that? That's intriguing. And I was going to ask you about that. How would you, if you did an energy model for Florida?
We have, and it's in fact, it's in the back of the Florida book.
Okay, that's called Environment and Society in Florida.
Yes.
By Howard and Elizabeth Odom and Mark Brown.
Right.
And what did that basically look like? Can you describe what the energy evaluation for Florida looks like?
Sure. It shows the components of real wealth, where they're coming from. And again, most of it's fossil fuel, directly and indirectly. That is either coming in as fuel